Hi, and welcome to the Diablo podcast, brought to you by PureDiablo.com, your home for an expansive community, an ever-growing wiki, and this podcast. Today, I am joined by Nineball.
Oh, hi.
DeAndra Lasrada.
Yes, hello.
And Brian Hidrigan.
Hello.
And I could just introduce you at the start with your names, but your names also attached to massive resumes. And I'm going to do a gigantic disservice by shortening it. So I don't know who wants to go first, but who are you and what have you done? And thank you for coming.
Man, thank you for having us. I know we're super delighted to do this. It's very exciting. As you mentioned, my name is DeAndra Lasrado. I have had a variety of work experience. I have kind of done everything that touches narrative in games. So I started off way back in the day at a company called BioWare, where I was an editor. I went on to Riot, where I was an editor. I worked at Snail Games, a small stint at XSEED. I worked at Carbine. I had a little deke into the anime side, but though I worked on a game there too at Aniplex. And then finally, I came to Blizzard, where I got to work in story and franchise development, as well as Diablo 4, because that's very relevant to this Diablo podcast.
Just a little bit.
And tiny bit. And then, of course, World of Warcraft. But yeah, I've done a whole bunch of things. Not quite as many as Brian, but still a healthy amount of things.
I'm old. Give it time. You'll catch up. Yeah. Well, I worked as a storyboard artist in the film industry for years. Then I jumped over to games to work at BioWare. Then I got sucked back into film for a while and then went back to BioWare a second time. Where I worked on Mass Effect 2, the first time I worked on Jade Empire, as both times as writers, as senior writers, actually. And then I went to Blizzard, where I was co-lead writer on StarCraft II Wings of Liberty and lead writer on Heart of the Swarm. And then I jumped over to the Diablo team. Diablo 3 had just come out. I had done a little bit of work on Diablo 3, just kind of helping the team out in the background. But I jumped over for the expansion, Reaper of Souls, as lead writer. And then after that, I worked on the live game for another year or two. And knowing the speed, I was at Blizzard for 7 years, and I released three titles. And knowing the speed at which Blizzard moves, I kind of looked into the distance, and I'm like, oh, I'm not going to release a game for like another decade here, am I? So then I moved on. I went to Epic Games as a narrative director, Ubisoft as narrative director, NetEase Games as a creative director. And then my most recent job, which I just started and which was actually just publicly announced today, as a creative director on an unannounced project at TME Tencent.
Congratulations.
Also, I realized.
Thank you.
I forgot to mention that I am no longer at Blizzard. I'm actually currently at Crystal Dynamics as lead narrative designer. So we had to.
On what game?
Oh, you'll have to wait. Watch the Twitter and you'll see. Again, once I'm allowed to say things, then you'll never hear me shut up about them.
I'm personally looking forward to that. And Brian, I do appreciate you running to PR. And getting it all cleared and breaking the news on our tiny little podcast. That is awesome. We've never broken news in any capacity. So this is a first. Slight note. I noticed you mentioned you mentioned animation. At no point, as you're summarizing yourself, do you mention that you got to work on Iron Giant?
Small yep. movie. Yeah,
just this little. This little indie film. Yeah, I did. No, I worked on. I worked on a variety of animated features and television, and then a couple live action features and television. But yeah, I think the one that people ask about the most is Iron Giant. Some people are fascinated to know that I worked on Space Jam, which is reaching way back into history now. But yeah.
My daughter would be more excited about Lion King 1.5.
yeah.
That I'm very proud of that. That's like the little film that could, you know.
It was not bad.
It did not have the biggest budget, and it was, you know, kind of different from anything else Disney was doing. So.
Mm-hmm. And it holds up again. And I don't say that from a condescending way. She would enjoy that more. Yeah. My son would enjoy Iron Giant, but he likes The Lion King. So awesome. But, you know, we're not here to necessarily talk about those stories. While they are impacting my children, the stories that you guys have been involved in that have impacted, I would argue, both of us, have been the ones in the Diablo universe. So when it comes to writing a story, like, I think we as people understand writing from a bare bones sense. You know, we've had to do some creative writing as we've gone through high school. You know, you envision someone slaving away at a typewriter because it's the 1950s. I don't know, for the purpose of this analogy, slaving away
mechanical keyboards.
Right, at their typewriter to produce this manuscript, and that's the story. You know, that they sat alone, they did it. But video games don't work that way. We don't have to go through any part of our life writing a video game narrative unless we get into that field. So I asked you guys to come here to talk about that, to talk about how video games actually go from idea to the game that we play, and how that all gets put together. And as you guys have had so many expansive roles, I'm looking forward to learning a lot today. So where do we start? Where do we start when it comes to a video game story? You've all had different roles.
I'm thinking that in a holistic sense, like not specific to any studio or any specific process, but as a holistic sense, the way that I like to explain it, especially when I do talks to, like, I talk to school children sometimes, and I find that you can find the best analogies that way. And my favorite analogy is for all the kids that want to get into games. I said, okay. So you want to get into games. I said, how do you like doing a group project? And they all, some of them look at me like, ooh. And others look at me like, okay. I was like, yeah, you kids that want to do a group project, making a video game is like making a group project together, because you sink or swim together. It's such a collaborative process. It's hard to like pick apart, you know, who starts here, who starts there. Like, from the idea, from the inception of, we're going to make this, you have everybody in their separate disciplines that say, okay, I'm an expert at this. Like, you know, maybe if you're building a statue, it's I'm an expert carver. Oh, I'm an expert at drawing, you know, the plan. Oh, I'm an expert at polishing the stone. I'm an expert at choosing the stone. Each one of those separate disciplines, they go out and they kind of look at the thing that they're making, and they say, I think this will be good. I think this will be good. I think this will be good. And then they all come together and say, these are all our good ideas. And you kind of have, it's almost like a hive mind, if you will. Like, there will be crossover in what everybody thinks a good idea is. So, you know, obviously, if everybody thinks it's a good idea, cool, we can go in that direction. And that kind of coalesces like the base of things, at least in my experience, that kind of coalesces the base of things. Now, when it comes to the nitty gritty, like stuff with narrative, that's piecemealed out. And again, that is still a collaborative process. Like, the worst narrative teams I find are the ones that are siloed away from every other point in game making and design and engineering, because you can't be off on an island on your own at any point in time. And true for any other part, but especially story. Story plays out in so many small ways that you just don't realize. Story is in systems. If you have systems that don't align with your world, that don't seem like they belong, that don't fit thematically within that world, it's gonna be weird. It'll take you out of that moment, right? Or even like level design, you stay in touch with them to be like, oh, these are, you know, it'd be weird if you're in, again, maybe a dark hellscape, but there's a lot of bright flowers or like super, super angelic looking stuff. It's just, that just won't jive. So it is a collaborative process where you all come together, you all kind of decide and agree, this is the core of what we're making. You take it away, you work on your parts, but you're still in high contact with each other and refining based on your skill set. Like, you know, I could never design a level. And honestly, like, I am an okay designer, but I'm not like a quest designer. I can never design a satisfying quest flow like a real quest designer can. What I can do is I can tell you story reasons why, you know, things happen, or I can at least suggest them to you, and we can work together to make something really beautiful. So it's kind of my end of thing. I don't know, Brian, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I think that's all really accurate. You know, from a more kind of high level approach to it. I mean, I guess I'd add the more mechanical side of it is that, you know, when you start on a game, or you're on a team that's starting on a game, there's a lot of stuff that is kind of like handed to you right away in terms of things that you that are going to restrict what you can do, right? So, you know, in the film industry, everything's about the idea. People walk into an office and they're like, okay, here's a story about a kid and his dog, and they go to the moon, right? And it's like, people either buy it, if they get excited about the story, everything else follows from that, right? Games, that is not the case at all. The studio is, you know, and the publisher more specifically is looking at, like, what game genre do we want to make? Like, what do we think there's an opening? Like, no one's making a good, you know, match three puzzle game or whatever. That'll never happen. There's always a billion of them. But, like, you know, so you start with a game genre, right? And then you start talking technology. What engine? What platforms are we releasing for? Are we doing simultaneous release across multiple platforms? Like all of these completely non-narrative things that have to get decided because of the expense and the risk of making a big game. You know, if you're an indie person sitting, you know, in your house and you're making a Twine game, you can do whatever you think is best, which is awesome, right? Mm-hmm. But a lot of these bigger projects, you know, you start with a team size, a technology, a game genre, a whole bunch of things that will limit what you can do. But limits aren't bad necessarily, right? But I mean, just to start with, you know, I mean, when I joined the Diablo team, someone told me, when you play Diablo, you should be killing something or picking up loot from something you just killed. If you're not doing one of those two things, something's wrong. You know, welcome to the team. Now tell a story, right? Like, you know. And I was like, that's not true. You also have to sell things. Don't forget.
Inventory management.
Everybody loves Tetris.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, did you ever just log into Diablo 3 and just spend 45 minutes like organizing your stash and then like, oh, now I have to go to work, but you feel like you got something done?
Yeah, that's me in Path of Exile at the moment.
Yes.
I have this lie where, you know, future Xanth way out is going to be a better person, and towards the end of a league we'll sort everything, and when it rolls over, it's going to be fun. That never happens. It's never going to happen. But anyways.
Yeah, ARPGs just kind of bring out the worst kind of pack rat in most of us, I think.
But, the lies we tell ourselves.
But I think so. That's the big thing about storytelling and the initial sort of impulse of storytelling. And part of the real skill of being a game narrative person, I think, is understanding, like, figuring out what the limitations are right at the top and figuring out how to do something that is good and compelling and moving and whatever, funny, whatever it needs to be within those limitations.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of constraints to make video games. And honestly, that is why a lot of video games have really compelling stories. Constraints make you good. When you have a wide open blank page, sometimes that's a little intimidating, but suddenly when you put actual like stop gaps in there, you're like, I can only go so far. It kind of, your mind wants to tease out the problem. How do I make this the most interesting thing possible with what I have here? Because that's truly like, we wake up every day. Another thing I like to say is that we wake up every day wanting to delight players. We don't always succeed, but like there is never a day that I wake up and I'm like, you know what? I'm going to cause problems on purpose. there's never a day that happens. I wake up and every day I stress and I think, and all I want to do is make players happy and make something that they'll enjoy. And even if that means, you know, causing them a little psychic damage or emotional damage, just a tiny bit.
Coming from, you know, a little bit of your film background, Brian, when somebody goes into a movie theater, they're gonna put their butt in the chair and they're gonna pay attention for 2 hours. With a video game, you have the option to bypass a lot of the work that you guys end up putting in. Is that something that comes into the equation as you guys start planning this? Of like, hey, how do we work with the story or work a story into something that, as you mentioned before, you kill things, loot things. How much of that conversation ends up coming up in terms of how you end up telling the story?
Oh, all the time. That conversation is omnipresent. You know, I think games have different strengths in film. I think they can be way more immersive, and just the interactivity, you know, brings its own level of engagement that a film, you know, when you're watching a film, you're passive. You're feeling things, but you're being told a story and it's coming into your face. And, you know, in games, you're participating in the story. Even if it's a linear story, just by the nature of it being an interactive medium. So I think you're always looking for ways to play to the strength of games, you know? And so, like, one thing I used to, I think I did a GDC talk about it years ago, is cinematics are these little slices of non-interactive where you want the player to sit back and put the controller down and watch it. So in my mind, as soon as the cinematic starts, there's a timer counting down, right? Where the player will, no matter how compelling it is, because you're asking the player to do something that's not what they sat down to do, which is play a game. So, I mean, don't get me wrong, cinematics are powerful and great, but like, you need to really respect the player's time in the cinematic, because if that counter reaches zero, they'll hit the escape key, and then they'll hit the escape key of every cinematic thereafter. And then they'll go, that story didn't make any sense. Like, so yeah, I think, you know, and Deandra, I'm sure you've had a lot of discussions like that as well.
Oh yeah. It's again, like I said, story is woven into everything. So it's, how are we still delivering our story even when it's a system? Like, how are we, like, even the objects you pick up, how is that telling a story? Even if it's not even flavor text, just the things that it says about the world, the thing it says about the world building. And how do I deliver story while you're doing things? Because that is the most successful form of story. Again, and it's the power of games and their interactivity, is you get to be an agent in your story. You get to choose your path. You get to feel like you're actually doing something as opposed to a passive medium. So how do I, because, like, I think cinematics are great as, like, very carefully done rewards for moments that you need somebody to pay attention to something in close detail. But for the rest of it, how do I just kind of passively, as you're running through and killing things, deliver this information to you? And it gets down to a science, too. And I know Brian can talk a little bit more about this in terms of, like, character barks. Like, how often does a character have to say something while you're fighting things to have you notice it? Because it's a lot more than you think. And again, once you get to a higher level where maybe you kill things a lot more easily, you kind of notice that. But when you're in the thick of it, it's, we are desperately just trying to give you, like, very pertinent information as quickly as possible. And in as concise a form as possible, so that you understand what's going on. Because again, the most unforgivable thing is having a narrative that just you're lost in and you have no idea why anything happens.
Yeah. And that's another area even where game genre comes into it, because, you know, in RTS, it's nearly impossible to call the player's attention to something unless you yank control of the camera away, which you would never, ever want to do. You know, I'm talking PvE, RTS, obviously, but, you know, it's just like the player will be in a pitched firefight way over on one side of the battlefield, and you'll have a little portrait pop up and a character will go, oh, they're attacking my base or whatever. And, like, you know, it's nearly impossible, to get the player's attention. Whereas in an RPG, you know, if your AI companion is going, I'm nearly dead, heal me, you know, the player will be a little more like, oh, I should probably
The screaming and the low health bar definitely help.
Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah. They're at least compelling to me.
So, you know, kind of coming back to like story starting to take shape. Mm-hmm. Both of you have worked on a game that was a sequel to another game. how does that start from a story perspective in terms of conversations about picking up? Now, obviously, D'Angelo, we know you can't talk about too many mm-hmm. specifics, but is there a meeting at any point where you have to sit down and go through the previous story and go, this is what we can keep, this is what we're building off of, and this is where we plan to go? Or does that just kind of happen organically as you guys are starting to put things together?
I would say that working on a sequel, and I've worked on sequels at other places beforehand, you always see what your predecessors have done, because what you have to remember, and again, this is just my opinion in terms of a general holistic sense of how you do this, having worked on sequels before at many other studios, my personal preference is to do it this way, which is you always look at what came before, because there are things that people loved in that moment. There's things that people respected in that moment. And it may not actually even be something that you yourself like. Like the things that people really love and wow are sometimes not the favorite things that I would want to bring forward. But you have to understand and respect why those people like those things. And then you have to holistically look at it to what you're bringing into the future and say, okay, this is essentially established lore, right? What about this established lore do they like? Why do they like it? How do I give them more of that while maybe also turning an IP in a newer, fresher direction, or sometimes like a more open-minded direction? Because, you know, some of these games were made a really long time ago, and, you know, decisions were made, absolutely. And it wasn't that anybody was trying to be malicious, it's just people involved were not thinking of certain perspectives. So if you want to turn an IP to be perhaps more inclusive and maybe welcome in a bunch of new people, yet still respect the lore, it's a really weird, not weird, it's a really difficult needle to thread in terms of how do I still respect what came before and where do I keep it now? And again, that's just my perspective on having to handle that. Some studios, they choose to say, we'll just wipe it clean. Like I've seen studios where they're just like, we're just going to wipe it clean. We're going to, you know, start from scratch. We'll take the pillars of what we think this is, and that's what people will grok onto. That's the thing that people will understand, but we're just going to wipe this slate clean. Other ways of doing it are we will pick and choose what we want, and then just for anything else, we're just not going to talk about it. Again, everybody has their own different way of doing it. Again, my preference is, even if you don't like the lore, you still kind of got to respect it, because you know what? A lot of people played that game and they really did like that. So it does me no service to be judgmental on things that make other people happy. So it's kind of a holistic sense of, again, several studios that I worked at and what they've done.
Yeah, I'd say, you know, on that, my personal watchword, not that it's worked out this way on every project, is kind of what Daniel was talking about. I try to understand what the IP is really about, what was the appeal, what was the thing that drew people to it. And it's such a minefield, though, right? Because a team or a studio can get almost kind of ritualistic about it. They're like, okay, well, you know, everyone loved our previous game and was a scene, a bucket up a drink from it. We got to have that, right? You know, and you're just like, okay, I don't think you sold 100 million copies because of the well bucket drinking scene. But so there can be a tendency to want to, you know, sort of repeat everything by rote somehow. And like, you know, because they're kind of scared that maybe there was a magic formula and if they veer from it. But then the other danger is, yeah, especially if it's a different team than the team that made the first game, there can be like, well, we're smart too, we can do our own, and like, you know, kind of a desire to a little bear syndrome, right? Maybe like kind of the other and you know your worth by far, right? So it's this minefield of like trying to figure out how to navigate, you know, and what was the real appeal of the original? But if it's been enough years, you know, also to understand that storytelling does evolve, you know, and a culture evolves of a country and of every country in the world, even just over the course of a decade, right? And so, you know, updating storytelling, being true to what the IP is really about, you know, sort of finding a way to speak to the underlying thing about the IP without sort of being beholden to everything that came before. And then the other part I would just say in answer to your question about how you approach it is one thing that makes a huge difference to me is, are you working with the team that made the previous game? So, so when I joined StarCraft II, that was 12 years after the first game had come out. And most of the people that worked on StarCraft I were not working on StarCraft II anymore. You know, some of them had left Blizzard, some had transferred to other teams. You know, there were a couple of key people. Chris Metzen was still, you know, but Chris Metzen at that point was a senior vice president, right, who was like working on every project. So he was still very engaged. But 12 years later, even he was a kind of a different person from the angry young man that worked on the original or whatever. So, you know, in that case, you know, you're working with the team that didn't make the original. You're kind of a detective looking for clues, like trying to figure out, you know, what they were up to and what really worked, and trying to remember you as a player playing it, like what you felt and why, you know. Whereas if you're with the team, so when I joined the Diablo 3 team, they had just shipped Diablo 3, and I started working on Reaper of Souls with the people that had just shipped a game, you know. And so that was very different. I think they had a very keen sense of like every mistake they'd made and everything that was not what it could have been. And, you know, they had a like when I joined Team 3, the Diablo 3 team, they had a very strong desire to, like, Reaper was going to be the thing where they were going to fix everything, and they were going to show everyone, you know, what it should have been and all of that. Which I personally think they did. I think it was really a great thing to behold. But so those are two very different experiences, and they were equally good, but it's just your role as like, as someone who wants to honor the previous title and still make something that's relevant today, changes a little bit depending on whether or not you're working with the people that made the first game.
So much to take in. It's all so, and Rush, edit this. This is just me gushing. It's just so interesting. Okay. Now cut back, Rush. He's going to leave that in because he'll be a jerk. Like, we'll just leave it. He doesn't pay that much attention. So you didn't say the word, so I have to bring it up. Retcons. 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 We've talked about it on this podcast before. We've debated the merits therein. How much of an argument happens? Because DeAndre, you talked about like it being a collaborative process and being a group project, right? Are there arguments around this kind of stuff? Do you, like, I'm not saying you get into fist fights, but maybe you do. That's a good story.
No, there's no violence. We are lovers to a one. You know, I am maybe known to be spicy here and there, but I am only spicy. The pen is mightier than the sword. I'm spicy with the words. As a narrative person should be. Retcons. So I feel like that's a whole bigger topic to itself, because, and this may make people angry, but what is a retcon? It's people sometimes use that word out of hand, and I find often use it out of hand when they mean you didn't make the story in my mind, because I had a belief that this was the way and you didn't give me the thing that's in my brain, and I'm upset about it. And we have a dear friend, who this is a phrase that kind of applies. I cannot meet your unexpressed desires. If you're expecting me to make the game that's in your brain, I'm sorry, I'm not a mind reader, and chances are I can't, because I have to serve a wider audience. What we try and do every day is we try never to retcon. Like, again, what you say is a retcon probably isn't, because sometimes people get stuck in the idea that characters must stay the same way forever. Like, they're never allowed to have character growth. Like, I saw this character and I love them and they're like this. And then if you ever give them a sense of growth and they change, they're like, well, that's not that character. It's like, no, but he went through, he or she or they or went through a process and they changed. Like, you have to allow, much like I believe you should let humanity change, you have to allow your characters to change, otherwise they don't reflect a real story. So a lot of times when I see, oh, this is a retcon, this is wrong, it's okay, but we just gave them character development. Or, well, this is a retcon because I learned this in this game and you're telling me that behind the scenes I didn't see all this stuff, so things happened that I had no idea that could happen here. That's a retcon. It's like, no, we're literally just giving you information that there's no way you could have known at the time. Because again, it's like Rashomon. There's many sides to a story to create a whole story. Sometimes you only get one perspective and maybe later you get a few more. Again, it leaves you at least open to telling newer, more interesting takes. And again, if it gets back to the story was maybe told like in the 90s, it gives you a chance to say, you know what, maybe we made some decisions in the 90s and we want to give a different perspective on it. How do we do that while saying the thing that existed still exists? There's not a single one of us that ever try and go, nope, this thing that we said existed, it doesn't exist. You're absolutely wrong, it doesn't. Usually it's this thing exists, but more people are around it and they have different thoughts and opinions about what happened here. Again, for any of the viewers, watch the movie Rashomon. It will change your world. It will make you think about how to approach story and quandaries a whole different way. I find it a very, very valuable film.
It is, for sure. I mean, I don't want
to
just
adding it to the list now.
Oh, Kurosawa. It's
Kurosawa, Rashomon. Yeah. No, it's a great one. I don't want to just repeat everything Deandra said. That's exactly what I'm going to do. No.
Copy paste.
I totally agree with all that. I think just to try to put an extra point on it, I have never knowingly retconned anything. Mm-hmm. I've never sat in a room with someone and said, all right, well, the previous game said this, but we're just going to say that. And then lit a fat cigar. Yeah. These kids, we just want their money.
Oh my God, no.
No, but
go back to the previous point. We just spend each day waking up wanting to make you happy.
Yeah. But I think people do often treat new lore as mm-hmm. a retcon, right? Like mm-hmm. like you know, if again, it's go watch Rashomon and come back and keep but like if you
everybody
see,
hit
if you
pause,
see
take a 2-hour break.
Watch. Come back.
And
if
now,
you see an event happen, but there was context to the event that you didn't know about in the first game, right? You saw an event happen, and then, you know, or you could also watch Dolores Claiborne, also another great film. But you know, then you get more context about there was stuff that you didn't know that was going on. People will immediately call that a retcon. Mm-hmm. And so there's new lore that gets called that. There's stuff when it's not fully revealed yet what's happening that gets called that. And I understand why. I don't think people are outrageous for doing that. I think it's the one of those like double-edged sword things. I talked about how players are fully engaged and have you know, they're interacting with the story. But that level of interaction with the story as a human being is going to make you feel a little bit like you own the story. And so when there's a treasured moment or scene that you thought happened a certain way, and then you find out there was more context or the narrative, you know, is slightly different than you thought, than you anticipated. But in your mind, as Deandra referenced, it's not just that you anticipated it, it had become canon already. That tends to kind of shock you out of it because it's a reminder of like, oh, I don't own this, right? you know, and we want people to feel that ownership and that engagement, but we have to tell a story. And sometimes the choices in that storytelling will have that shocking effect.
You cannot make everybody happy, nor should you strive to, because that is how you get a very bland narrative. It is better to be polarizing than it is to be bland.
Yes. Yeah. I say, and I'm exaggerating slightly when I say this, but I sometimes say I'd rather make something that 51% of people love and 49% hate than something that everyone's like, yeah, it's okay. You know?
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting with that, you know, because that is something like taking it back to Diablo 3. They had made the decision that the Dark Wanderer, the warrior from Diablo 1, was King Leoric's son. You know, and that a lot of people are like, oh, retcon. It's like it didn't change anything. It just added context to who your character was.
Right.
That was it. Like, but a retcon that a lot of people don't like to talk about is that in Diablo 1. Angels were flesh and blood creatures. They weren't all hoods and light and sound and stuff. So the awesome cinematic we just got with Venarius and such, if that had never been retconned in Diablo 2, we wouldn't have had, you know, that badass. We wouldn't have Tyrael's wings. You're welcome.
Right.
You know, so it's just, it's one of those things that, like, not all retcons are bad. And just as you had, you know, all very, you put much better than I had in a previous episode, not everything that someone calls a retcon is a retcon.
Yeah. And I think in the case of angels being flesh and blood people versus angels being light and sound, like, it's, I can only imagine, again, I was not there. I was very young, thank God, when that was there. But I can only imagine that they made that decision because how do you move your IP forward? Like, you make a game, it's very popular. Maybe you don't expect to make another game. And suddenly you have this very popular thing and you're like, oh, I have to make another one. But now there's constraints and then there's hard limitations. So that I could see as being a hard limitation. I didn't think about my world beyond the scope of, say, Tristram and Hell, right? When I suddenly have to build it out, oh, I have to make decisions. And that's one where I can see, yeah, sometimes you'll have to make an actual retcon, but it's to serve the fact that you have to actually build a world that is much more expansive. And again, like, these games are old. Like, back in the 90s when I was playing Diablo 1, and absolutely, I played Diablo 1, I played Diablo 2, and I played Diablo 3. It's when you make something in the 90s, I don't think you expect it to make another game like we do now. These days, when we make stuff, we're like, oh, this could have the potential to make, you know, sequels. And so when we build games now, we do it from the standpoint that we're building a holistic world that feels good and makes coherent sense. So games nowadays, a lot of times, if you see them starting, like, maybe even as late as the aughts to now, They're conceived of whole hog. They have rules. They have, like, wide expanse of world building. But yeah, a game from the 90s, like, that I played when I was maybe in eighth grade. Like,
yeah. I mean, I can totally understand the temptation to retcon stuff, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like the wing thing that you mentioned, Nineball. Like, you know, because, as Deandra said, there's decisions that some person sitting at their computer in 1998 made that they didn't even know was important, right?
Mm-hmm.
That 10, 15 years later, you're sitting there going, how do we get around this? Our IP needs to move on from this. And how do we,
we are stuck here.
But we are stuck in this place. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that to me is the key thing is interestingly, because Deandra, you mentioned the 90s, but I think it extends through the odds all the way to today.
Oh, really?
I think that I've probably made decisions in my career that somebody else is sitting there right now
that's
going,
true.
How the hell do we deal with this stupid thing that Brian came up with, right?
Like, that's true.
Because you never know as an IP grows where it needs to go, the challenges it will come up against, the things it needs to overcome, or even real world events that'll happen that people like, you know, like, oh, let's not deal with themes of this, right? You know, let's stay away from that kind of thing. So that, you know, the nature of an IP to be this, like, bridge to the past, you know, creates this constant need to sort of examine everything and figure out how to kind of maybe not break it, but bend it as much as you can?
I think in the case where you literally have to retcon something, I find I've seen this happen before where people are just straight up about it. They just say, hey, this thing, we're changing it. And this is why. And you can agree with it or you cannot. But we're not gonna try and like make a big explanation. We're just literally telling you we're changing it for this reason, you know. And you know.
Yeah.
And sometimes decisions were made and you want to unmake those decisions because it was a bad decision.
Right. I mean, comic books have been using multiverse and time mm-hmm. travel as their two main tools to we're not really changing the continuity. That was just a different planet.
Yeah. Different timeline, it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been lucky, I guess, that I've never had to do. I've always found a sneaky way to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Brian, as we talk about Diablo 3, we did kind of get left with a little bit of a cliffhanger. Are you worried about your story being retconned?
I'm not in general. So there's a weird thing about being a creator or creative in games is that much like the player who feels ownership of the thing they're playing, you feel ownership of the thing that you're creating because that's your day to day. You think about it when you're driving home and you think about it as you're falling asleep and all this stuff. So you feel like you own something, but you don't own it. And you have to remember at the end of the day that there is a giant multinational corporation publicly traded on the stock market who owns that asset, right? And mm-hmm. then like whether it's a character that you wrote or the story of a campaign or the way you advance an IP, anything, right? That you know, there's the soulless part of it that I referenced, but there's kind of a good side of it too, which is this: someone else, some other creative, is going to take over the thing that you owned, and hopefully they respect what you did, and hopefully they try to honor it the same way that I try to honor and respect. Does everyone else hear like a bunch of static, or is that just me?
No, it's coming through.
Deandra, okay. is that the cat?
I think it's the cat. She likes to mess things up. I could go on mute for a second.
You know, so if you like write a character and then there's a sequel, someone else comes along and they write that character in that sequel. You know, they have to try to make it their own. They can't write the whole character just from the perspective of what would Brian do, right? I mean, they want to be true to the character and follow the character, but they don't need to be true to Brian, right? So I'm not too worried about, you know, being retconned. I don't know anything about the Diablo 4 story, just to be clear. So I don't, you know, ask me again after it comes out. No. I mean, I suppose the creative inside of me always has this little bit of like, I wouldn't have done it that way. But
It's funny because there is one specific thing. You know, we had done a stream together almost a decade ago, where we were talking about like what would come next after Reaper. And one of the things was that with the Black Soul Stone destroyed, you know, what happened to all of the evils, you know, the greater evils and lesser evils. And at the time, it was the idea that they would still be one thing as the prime evil. But as we've seen with what they put out for Diablo 4, Duriel was in, you know, the announcement, right. Gameplay, cinematic. We've seen concept art for Andariel. So obviously that is not the direction that like the current creative team went with.
Right. Yeah. And that sort of thing is going to happen. You know, and I mean, again, there's always a real danger of thinking that, you know, everyone should have just followed what we were working on. But you know, to be honest, we were also setting up, and I believe this is out. I believe
King of the North.
I was gonna say expansion 2.
Yeah.
I believe this is out there, right? Like what we were setting up was the storytelling that we were gonna continue to do in a second expansion. And then the second expansion was weirdly canceled.
Yeah.
I think hastily and ill thought out plans, but so you know, I mean, and again, as you said, that was 10 years setting up a story that we were going to tell another expansion. Mm-hmm. It was going to come out 10 years ago, and the team, you know, some people on were there on Diablo 3, but the team has gone elsewhere. So it's kind of a moment in time, and moment is past. So, you know, I hope my hope is that the team and supported by Blizzard's departments, tools, you know, it's going to be a surprise and for that. But, you know, honoring particular you know, the team I was on was heading. Not necessary. I didn't mean to bring everyone down, though.
No, not at all. You kind of brought it up in talking about like that lack of ownership, but also ownership. A game like Diablo 3 sells, and Nineball, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but like 60 million copies. 65 million, right?
I think that they had like the last update was like the last official figures was only like 30 million, and then but that was like from like 2013. It was it was only a year or two like after it had released. So
I had heard a higher number than that.
I had heard
but
a higher number
know.
As well. Yeah.
Yeah, the number I heard was 50 million, but I don't know.
That they had stopped officially announcing like the sales figures. So if there was something you know that you might have picked up or heard, but I want to say that they had stopped announcing it shortly after Reaper.
Oh, okay.
I've purchased it several times, so I think I've pushed it up there. we'll stick with my 60 million number, but 60 million people have experienced the story that you have been responsible for, right? You know, any other author out there, like that's an astronomical amount of people. And then like, you know, to have that kind of ownership, but then also to not, man, there's a question in here somewhere. I think it's more of how do you deal with that of like being responsible for a story that is ingrained in people's lives, and it doesn't have to be Diablo, but it can be in anything, but then also not having like that for as much of what you've put in, you also don't have it. Like you don't own it. You don't take it out with you in every regard that you can.
Yeah, that's, I have an answer to that, but I did want to just jump into something from the premise of your question, which was about me kind of, you know, well, you didn't say author, but me sort of being primarily responsible for the story. So I should just, you know, I just want to mention that it is definitely, you know, with a few exceptions, you know, like maybe a Ken Levine or someone, it's really not an auteur medium, you know. So, you know, when I like wrote Jack in Mass Effect 2 or Samara, like I wrote that dialogue, I pictured all the interactions, I understood everything about how that character, I came up with the plots of their acquisition and loyalty missions. I really felt, you know, personal ownership in the creative sense. On something like Reaper of Souls, you know, I come in, I've got the support of the franchise and development IP, you know, creative development team who sort of understand the IP. I've got, you know, Chris Metzen, you know, who's always got lots of amazing ideas. I've got a writing team of people, you know, and then I've got the wider Diablo team. There's like so many resources and so many inputs and so many really good inputs to the story that at a certain point, and I still feel the ownership of being the creative person on it, but a creative person on it. But like at a certain point, you know, you're really managing the flow of these talents, right? So, you know, for instance, in Reaper, you spend a lot of time at the beginning in the city of Westmarch, and at a high level narrative, I was like, these are the things that need to happen in Westmarch. You meet this character, you have to disable these things that that Malthael's minions are using to turn people into, you know, other stuff and all that. But the person who just sat there and really like wrote Westmarch and really like put the encounters in and really figured out all these subplots that you could find. You know, remember there's like a whole subplot where the nobles, as their city is being destroyed, the nobles are like planning to overthrow the lord of the city or whatever. Right. That was Leonard Boyarsky. Leonard just went and like a machine and did it, you know? So there's like so many levels to it that, you know, as Deandra's finding as a lead narrative designer now, the higher you go, the less you actually do the thing that you got into it because you love doing. And the more you're a cheerleader telling people, keep going, you're doing great. So
pretty much.
Yeah. So I just wanted to clarify that. As far as the like how you deal with it, or if I understood the question correctly, is like how do you deal with feeling that ownership but knowing you don't? I find alcohol helps a lot. You know, cheers. Crying, yeah. crying yourself to sleep.
Lots of weeping softly in cars.
Yeah, yeah. Go out to the parking lot and just yell in your soundproof car. No, I'm kidding. No, it's part of the maturing of the as a creative. I think the stages that you have to work through is at the beginning you fall in love with and feel ownership of everything all the time, right? And then I think some people go through a bitter, cynical period when they realize that they don't own it, where they're kind of like, I'm just a hired gun. I'm a typewriter monkey, whatever, you know, just tell me what to type. I don't care. Right. And then the real maturity as a creative comes when you get through to the other side of that and you learn how to care and be invested. But also just keep that, you know, that thing in the back of your head that like, you know, enjoy it while it lasts or right. Because this is a special moment in time. I'm creating this story and it's fun and everything, but you know, 4 years from now, or in Blizzard's case, 20 years from now, some other team will be working on it and another version of the story, and they'll be doing their thing. And, you know, and that's okay. That's good. Right. But.
Absolutely.
That's an awesome, like the, in terms of like the mature answer. Right. And I do appreciate the calling me out on that. You are right. It is a team that did put the whole story together. So you all get ownership of it, and then you should brag about it a little bit more.
And we all have to return to alcohol afterwards. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So in your time writing, guys, has there ever been anything that you had to fight over? That was more argumentative, that you wanted in the story or didn't want in the story, or is it always easy writing with other people? Oh, I can't imagine it is, right? Like, I can't imagine, as you talked about doing a group project, that you don't want to fight as you're getting invested in the lore, mm-hmm. that you don't want to fight about some of these characters. Like, no, that's not how I want this character to be. Is there anything that stands out, or is it just, is it as contentious as I imagine it in my head?
I think it depends on the team, right? So there are some teams that I feel like, and this gets back to being a good lead. If you're a good lead, you've curated a good team of people that you know will work well together. And that's, to me, team building is just as important as each person's individual contribution. Because again, we're collaborative medium. But, you know, sometimes you'll have disagreements about like where a character should be and what a character should be. And that's kind of why we have levels in hierarchy almost, right? Somebody has to be kind of the key IP holder. And that's usually as you get up to your directorship, or like you have your directors who are kind of like they keep the high level goals in mind. You have the leads that kind of enforce those goals, but also do like management, and they also, you know, make sure things stay clear. So if two, we call them individual contributors or ICs, want to have a fight about, I think the character should be this, I think the character should be this, you kind of have to appeal to a higher power who has to be reasonable and listen to both sides and say, okay, I understand why you want this and the good and bad here. I understand why you want this, the good and bad here. But this is the purpose that we are trying to serve. Now, do both of these hit them? No, but what parts of each of them do that we could bring together to, again, hit our pillars, as we like to say? You know, does this serve who the character is? And In the end, you can get a solution that probably nobody is completely happy with, but nobody's completely unhappy with either. And honestly, that's the best solution. But again, that requires kind of a specific team that can work well together collaboratively. I've been in teams where it has been, and again, I've been in game dev for a really long time. And as a woman of color in game dev, you know, sometimes there are things that I would have to fight for, like inclusion. People that look like me. And sometimes that's a throwdown, knockdown fight because you're fighting against an institution like way back then. It's well, we don't have stats that any of that sells and what you want, it's too edgy or what have you, or not edgy enough, or, you know, I don't think people, it doesn't test well, people don't play that. And it's really, well, we don't know that because we've never made it. So how about we make it and we find out for sure if it's that thing. But again, that's, it's different fights, different places. It all has to do with the people that you hire and the team that you build, truly.
Yeah, I'd add that I think when you were first asking, like, have you ever had to fight? I was kind of starting to smile because I'm like, every day.
Yeah. There's always something to fight. You want to keep pressing forward and getting the most that you can, and it's figuring out how to do that.
Yeah, and you could think of it, I mean, for better or worse, I mean, there's teams that do it in a better way and teams that do it in a worse way, but making a game is it's a scarcity mindset for resources, right? Like, anytime you want to do something, you're somehow taking something away from game design or level design, or, you know, you're asking an engineer to work on something, a programmer to work on something for an afternoon, but that's an afternoon that he could be doing UI stuff or whatever, right? Like, so there's lots of fights about that. There's lots of fights about story is one of those things that everybody thinks they're good at. You know, everyone's like, I grew up reading books and I've watched a lot of movies. I'm practically the same thing as an Oscar winning director. I don't know. No one's ever said that. But you know what I mean? Everyone in their heart of hearts. In my entire 30 years in creative endeavors, I've had one person, an art director, say, I'm not good at this story stuff. Why don't you just tell me what the story is and I'll do the art? And I was like, I want to work with you forever.
The dream.
Yeah. And to be fair, plenty of people who are not writers or narrative people are good at story. They have good instincts. I'm not saying, mm-hmm. but the point is everyone thinks they're good at it. So everyone has strong opinions and everyone gets a little sensitive. People who are otherwise pretty tough, you know, cold-eyed professionals, they come to you and they're like, I came up with this cool idea. And you're like, yeah, thanks. We can't use that. And it hurts them. Right. So yeah. So it's tough. There is a lot of wrangling for that kind of stuff, you know, and so you learn early on. And add on top of that, most narrative people, Deander is the rare exception. Most of us narrative people are like not people. We're not good at like feelings, and you would think we'd be good at communication, but we are on the page, but not interpersonal, right? Like, so that leads to a lot of problems as well. But yeah, so there's fight. But there can be healthy fights, right? Like some, you know, I would say design at Blizzard when I was there on both teams was fairly confrontational, but sometimes in an unhealthy way. But often there was a healthy kind of like, well, I think you're wrong, and I got a whiteboard full of diagrams that prove that you're wrong, so let's talk it out, right? You know, like, I think that's okay. Like, I like to, I you know, I come from an Irish-American family where the dinner table was like a courtroom, right? Like, I like to, all my siblings are lawyers, actually. So, like, I like to argue stuff out and talk it through. So
I can attest to that.
I just married into an Irish family. I know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. No, I would say that, especially on my time on WoW, again, the collaborative process, figuring things out, is like, I was so excited to work there because on World of Warcraft, I worked with a bunch of adults. Like, we had to talk about stuff. Again, it's a little bit, Brian is correct that it is a little bit me. I'm a very social person. I have absolutely no problems reaching out and figuring things out as long as people are willing to communicate and try hard in their communication to be open. Absolutely. No problems at all. So, yeah, World of Warcraft, it's everybody is very passionate. Everybody is very invested. Everybody really loves the product that they're making. So when it comes to, you know, getting into things and figuring things out, it's always okay to discuss, because you know that you're all working together towards a common greater good. Like, you kind of know that the person that you're arguing with, sometimes they want the bet what's best for the game, just like you do. So that even in the moment, if you might be a little hurt here and there, you still know, no, this person just really cares, and we can work through it. I've been in other environments that have been a little bit less that, where it's, you know, they're not necessarily working for the greater good of what the team is or what the goals are. They are just working for their own personal greater good. And that's when you get more of like the bad kind of contentious fighting, like Brian said.
You mentioned, you know, kind of having like different levels and having a decider. When it comes to story, who gets the ultimate say? Like we, as a team, you're coming together. Like, who's the top of the food chain that says this can or can't happen at the end of the day?
I have most normally had it be basically like the narrative director, sometimes the creative director, but the creative director is a much larger scale job than narrative director. But when it comes to the story, this is what the story is, this is what the story isn't. If the narrative director says this is what the story is, that is what the story is. Now the narrative director can get marching orders from, you know, way higher on up. But that's just at a huge IP level that we down below, we're not concerning any of them with. It's that has to be a big sweeping change. For the story that you would interact with and see, for me, it's always been a narrative director.
Yeah, there's a weird kind of thing. As you get higher and you see a little more behind the curtain, where I think the answer is almost nobody. The real decider in chief is usually like tech debt and schedule and manpower.
That's fair. Yeah.
You know,
we can't execute the story.
But beyond that, you have these descending levels of like, so every project has the equivalent of an executive producer, an EP, right? And that person is responsible for 10 billion things. And ultimately, they could come in and overrule everyone and a junior writer on, you know, the Oxford comma if they want, right? But they can't possibly do that. Like, that's just insane. In terms of there only being 24 hours in a day, and in terms of them losing their job in about a month if they try to do that too much, right? So mm-hmm. So they can occasionally get, like, they have just something stuck in their head, you know, I went to the movies with my kid this weekend, I saw this thing, it's great, let's do that, mm-hmm. right? You know, then you have a creative director who also has this huge portfolio, you know, then you get, you know, Deandra centered on the narrative director, because that's where it finally becomes like fully home to narrative. Mm-hmm. But beyond the narrative director, there are other personages who can try to overrule the narrative director, or, you know, try to bully them into doing something if they're so inclined. But they can't do it often. You know, if they're smart, they'll never do it at all, right? Mm-hmm. But like, you know, and then the same, even from the narrative director on down, the narrative director can overrule the lead writer, but she would be foolish to do so, right? The lead writer can impose discipline on their other junior writers, but they'd be foolish to do that too much, right? So, and there's another kind of zeitgeist thing I'd say I found. If the team in general, like a 110 person development team, whatever, much bigger these days, I guess, really hates an idea, you're unless you have a reality distortion field around you, which some people do have, and I'll explain that term in a second, but unless you have that, that idea is not going to go. You can't just will it into existence. If the team is not buying it, eventually someone higher up the food chain than you is going to go, let's cut that idea. The team has never bought it, right? So the reality distortion field is some people just have they have this magical ability to walk into a room full of skeptical people and go, it's going to be a game about blimps and they're all going to be purple. It's going to be great. You're going to love it. And by the time they leave the room, everyone's going, purple blimps. Why didn't we ever think of this before? You know, it's a rare skill. I don't have it. Chris Metzen does. He and I have talked about that a number of times, that he absolutely does. You know, so So if you have that, then, you know, then I guess you, in theory, it's all going to go your way. Mm-hmm. But without that, yeah, you really have to take the temperature of the team.
I'm stealing the purple blimps idea, by the way. So
you, it's you yours.
You didn't copyright it. So
a mere 20% of your gross is all I require.
I do have kind of like a little like follow-up question on that one when talking about kind of like the hierarchy of the teams. Earlier you had mentioned that you had like kind of like the Diablo team, but then while at Blizzard there was also then the separate, you know, like creative development team that was then outside of the Diablo team. What was that like, you know, as far as writing goes? Like, is there like directions that come from them, or are they like a resource that you can tap for questions about like the IP and such? It was always kind of interesting that there's your IP specific writing team, and then there's like this overarching creative team at Blizzard that helps out or works on various projects. I've never understood how it integrates into one another.
Well, I would say story and franchise development, you know, they support the game teams. They really do. They are fabulous partners. They, you know, make all those beautiful cinematics you see. They're the people that'll help do the tie-in novels and whatnot. Like when I was on Story and Franchise, I was in the creative development subdivision and I did art books. So actually Book of Adria was one that I helped out with, and my name's in there. I'm very happy. The first two got
book.
It is. It was delightful to edit. Brian gets the first two, but I get that one. So, but, yeah, story and franchise development also houses the lore team, and the lore historians. Oh my God, they are so important. They are the ones that like they catalog everything that we say and make and do, so that when we ourselves, you know, we're just a lot of words in there. When we forget it, we can go back to them and they can say, hey, this is what you said at this time, or they could even go back further in history and say, hey, this is what we already said about this character. And it's never done with a purpose of like, okay, now this is what this character said, like, you know, 20 years ago, you have to adhere to it. It's more done with, hey, they said this, people might think that that's special to them. Make an informed decision about who this character is and how you go forward. And we can give you suggestions if you want, or we could just give you information. Again, it's true partnership. So when it comes to, say, making our cinematics, which is, of course, what SFD does as well, they will work with the game team and they'll be like, okay, what is the story that you're trying to present? We are experts at making these movies, so we can present you, you know, the cinematography that'll support that. And sometimes even, you know, there's bigger cutscenes that, say, the team, their writing team there will handle as well. But they will, of course, work with the game team very closely to say, okay, what are the themes of what's going on? What characters are we using? What's the setup here? You know, but they give it just that extra little bit of polish. But they would never, in my experience having worked there, they would never create something that the game team wasn't aware of, because you can't just take stuff on the outside and be like, oh, we're just going to run in this whole new direction and now you have a game that has to support that. That's not the way the games work. It's we make the game, and again, they'll be like, hey, we're thinking about this as a new exciting direction, will that work in the game? Absolutely. Or hey, you know, like, just a heads up, we're making this game. This is the lore. This is what we're doing. Just so you know, in case that changes anything of yours. Again, it should be a very symbiotic, very, very collaborative relationship. So even though they're a separate team because they support a bunch of other teams that are a huge department, it's really something special with their collaboration.
Yeah, I'd say there are other publishers out there that have franchise teams where there might be a game team making a game, but then there's this weird sort of extra legal, you know, kind of group of people over here who can sort of, without being in the day-to-day of the game, they can cite it like that. You can't do that because our IP would never happen. In theory, they're supposed to be protecting the IP. In practice, you know, of the few instances that I know, it just feels like a weird interference, you know. But what Deandra said is absolutely true at Blizzard. At least my experience when I was there, which was a long time ago now, they were very much customer service oriented, and the game team was the customer. So, you know, the folks in creative dev is what it was called when I was there. You know, they would turn to me they would get my approval for if they had a if they were going to do a novel, and then they would write an outline, and then they would send it to me to approve, or they would ask my approval on even sometimes like marketing stuff, you know. And I'd be like, I'm trying to write a game, why are you asking me about this? but no, it was very collaborative, and the game team was the flagship of the IP. So the game team was the one who said, this is where we're going, this is what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. So before, I have two follow-up questions. First, mm-hmm. Oxford comma, yay or nay, and then Oxford comma.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Oh, this is an Oxford comma house. I mean, as far as I know, this is an Oxford comma house.
Yeah, I'm totally. I dig it, baby. I'm into the Oxford comma. I once did some writing that she edited, and I had just like forgotten to put an Oxford comma, and she literally added a comment that said, "Oxford comma, do it for the children."
Yes.
So my wife works in public relations, and she is anti-Oxford comma, and she will ask me to edit things, and I always add it, and then I'm happy to see there are households out there that are clearly in the right and are not divided.
I think there was a ruling on this actually where they said, nope, the Oxford comma is actually just the correct way to go. There, I remember. I think engineers would agree that at least in engineering rules, the Oxford comma is correct. But also, just as a side note, I only edit him in a very specific way because I know I can put whatever shit inside.
She's cool.
It's useful. Your writing gets better.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So it's not just about the Oxford comma. I'm curious about the pressure that comes with story writing around a video game, because if you're solo and you put out a novel and it doesn't do well, okay, right? But you and a team are coming together and you're writing under a successful IP or a new IP, but for a company who's traded on the New York Stock Exchange, right? And if it doesn't do as well, then the company suffers and the people you work with suffer. We go back to a continual of like, oh, there's a question here. How do you manage that in the back of your head? Is that something that you put out entirely in the process and that you're just fully into? Or is that something that is you're cognizant of during?
I take that very seriously. Like I take my job very seriously. And again, as a lead, the way that stress manifests within me is that, again, I'm not necessarily the person that is going to be the one writing things all the time these days. I will have certain tasks here and there, but truly that's for my individual contributors that I work with, that work under me. I want to make sure that they are supported and know what our pillars are, like what we are writing about. I want to make sure that's as clear as possible to them. I want to make sure that the characters that we've been given are as clear as possible so that they can be successful in writing them. And if you have an IP that already exists, it is a little bit easier in some ways because you can see examples of how that character speaks and acts and talks. And so they have examples there already. And so it's just you making sure that this sounds believably like the character it was before. Again, even if they go through, you know, a character arc, even if they go through growth, they still sound and are very like true to themselves, if you will. So you know, it is a thing where you're like, yeah, sometimes you wake up and you're like, if I fuck this up, sorry, I don't know if I can swear on this.
Yes, you can swear.
It's a mature rated video game.
Right. Yeah. I'm surprised I lasted this long, but yeah, no, if you fuck this up, this is people's jobs on the line. This is, you know, not only will I have disappointed fans, but honestly, like I need this to do well for me and for other people, but to me, that just gives me the impetus to try and be excellent every day and bring a level of excellence every day to my job. Because again, it's how do I support others to make us do the best job that we can. And again, Brian likes to say, you know, nobody sets out to make a bad movie. Nobody sets out to make a bad game. Sometimes there's just external factors that happen and it is what it is. But like everybody tries every day 110% to make something that's successful.
Just yeah. As a side note, our editor only gets angry if anybody ever says Cheerios wings. So
good to know.
It's true.
Yes. Yeah, no, I agree with all that. I mean, I think that's, you know, it doesn't like sort of weigh heavily on me every day, but like absolutely it's in my mind that, you know, we've gotta make something good. For, you know, for a variety of reasons, like, you know, A, there's I'm a gamer, right? So I know there's people out there that are going to spend money on this that want to enjoy it. And they want two things, one, to enjoy it, and two, to not be enraged by Tyrael's wings. Oh, so, you know,
you're welcome, Rush.
but, you know, and then beyond that, yes, there's the team, there's the people, everyone. You know, this is their livelihood. This is how they pay their mortgage. This is how they feed their kids, right? Like, so we've got to make something that does well and enables people to keep working, right? You know, and then there's the company, which some of these are giant, you know, multinational companies, like I said, but still, they're showing an enormous amount of trust in me. And maybe I shouldn't even say the company, it's the leadership of the division of the multinational corporation that I'm in, right? But like, you know, they're showing enormous trust in me, you know, and so I want to do great all around. I want the game to be great all around like that. So the other one thing I'd add is, you know, a weird thing about working in games, though, is you can't always tell. Like, there are games out there that have sold crazy amounts that people and Reddit think are flops, right? And there's other games out there that have not sold many copies that people and Reddit think are huge hits. And I'm not equating critical success to financial success, but because we're talking about the financial part, you know. So there's, you know, it's there's sometimes a weird perception, even within a studio, I think, about the success of a project. So, and of course, publishers really do hide a lot of those numbers. As we saw when we turned out, we all had a different number for Diablo 3, right?
Right.
I did actually look it up, and the last official statement that they had made was in 2015, it had sold 30 million copies.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
And they used to do infographics on how many people were playing in the seasons and all this other type of stuff, and then it all just stopped.
Right.
They stopped releasing any type of the player data, sales figures or anything. And then you had, you know, after that you had like the next gen releases, you had the Switch release, all other types of stuff, the Rise of the Necromancer and all these other things that came afterwards.
Right.
And they just, 30 million. Yeah.
I mean,
I'm feeling it's a little bit more.
just slightly. A smidge.
I got a new copy of Diablo 3 today. like I'm not even making that up. I got a copy for Switch because it's cold, as we discussed earlier pre-show, and I run on a treadmill, and I will play Switch while I run. So I needed a copy of Diablo 3 for that. So
I am so 30
million in one
run and play a game.
I would fall off that treadmill. So fallen off a treadmill.
I use my copy of the Switch to test the projectors at work for Diablo 3 on the Switch. Mm. So, you know, not physical activity. I sit there and watch movie screen, but, you know,
nice.
same thing, right? Right?
Yeah.
My Switch is just my Animal Crossing machine. I'm sorry.
actually, there's a good transition there as we're talking, as you bring up, you know, what you're playing. Two-parter. I mean, what is the best story that you've been involved in, and what is the best story you think in games that you've experienced?
Oh man, subjectivenesses.
And we have time. We can slow down. Rush can edit this out while you think, because you weren't prepped for this.
Oh man.
Don't, While they're going through and thinking of it, there's something that I wanted to go through and say when Brian was talking about film and video games and such earlier. I just watched the first episode of The Last of Us, like right before this podcast. And of course, there's the scene with Sarah that if you play the game, you know what it is. And if you haven't, I won't spoil anything. But while watching the scene in the TV show, I was thinking about my experiences in the game. You know, going back to how you feel as if you've played the story in the game, how it's like you have like an ownership of that experience, and it's just so much more because you're interacting with it and it's happening with you instead of just watching it. That even though it was great, you know, storytelling within that episode, my feelings that came out of it all came from the game I played 10 years ago. You know,
right. Right.
So thinking about that question, it's really interesting because they're almost actually two very, very different questions. Because the greatest story that I've been involved with, that means that I am looking at it from like an objective, like player standpoint. And there's so much that goes into like working on a story and feeling fulfilled and like your best experiences that has nothing to do about the objective good or bad of that story. I would say that the two that really just stand out in my mind are when I was working on WildStar at Carbine, like the group of professionals that I worked there, I met some of my best friends there. Like I'm still in touch with these people, even though that game has been like RIP close to my heart still, but gone for quite some time now. Like that creating that story with those people, that was one of the best professional experiences ever. And honestly, like Dragonflight. I think Dragonflight as a WoW expansion is so special and so delightful. And seeing the way that team grew to make it and the team that was involved making it, like it was such a labor of love and healing. And it is a sincere, sincere love letter to the fans saying, you know, we love this as much as you do. And everybody, they like, we put our most wholesome part into it while also trying to tell, you know, a serious story about like these larger powers. But the focus of that game was really like, we want you to be delighted and we care so much about it. So I'd say that was a really special working experience. Also for just the zones that I worked on, you know, my counterparts, I was the narrative lead assigned to a couple of zones. And then I worked with the quest lead and of course the level design lead, and just the cohesive units that we were together and how we work together. That's truly what makes that a special story to me, because it's my agency and how I worked and what I did. In terms of things that I just sit down and experience though, I really loved What Became of Edith Finch. I think that's a really special story. And I think that was a story that was really engrossing to me, because as much as I work in games, it's for something to really touch me. I'm a kind of a weird hipster art house person. So indie games can be my jam, like Gone Home. But What Became of Edith Finch, that definitely was one of the best interactive experiences that I ever got to do. I think what gets in my way sometimes is, and games have gotten better in this regard, is that I really just want to experience a story. Like I have no problem with visual novels. I think visual novels are great. You brought up The Last of Us. I really enjoyed The Last of Us 2 because I was not on the sticks for it. Brian was. He played through and I got to watch that story. Same with like Ghost of Tsushima. But I really enjoyed seeing the story of Last of Us 2. But I know that if I had played it, I don't think that I would have, because I don't think this is too spicy an opinion, but honestly, I don't think that those games, both Last of Us and Last of Us 2, have great gameplay. I think they are gorgeous stories that I would love to see in a visual novel as opposed to play through meh gameplay to get to the thing that I want to see, which is the story. For the ones that, you know, kind of seamlessly do both of those together, again, sometimes I'm not as good at playing games as other people, and if I get frustrated, it takes me out of those storytelling moments. So again, that's why something like Edith Finch, perfect. It's puzzles, it's easy enough for me to go through and still be invested in without feeling like I am failing all the time. So kind of my thoughts on the thing that I worked on and thing that I enjoyed.
Yeah, I think I don't think I could say what game I've been involved with that I think is the best story. Just because for me they're all my children. Mm-hmm. No. Yes, they are all my children.
I have two kids, and I'm gonna say on each day I have a favorite. It changes all the time.
Well, I was so gonna like, say the other
what
thing,
one is
though,
bothering
is
me the most.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and this is kind of an aspect of that too, is I also think that each one represents a different sort of time in my life, right? Like I had a blast working on Mass Effect 2. Part of that was because I was a senior writer and my job was just to sit there and churn out great dialogue and writing and characters. And I had a great lead who like gave me cover, you know, and let me do things. And you know, even would even say stuff to me like, I don't really get this humor stuff. I don't think we should have humor, but like you seem to be pretty good at it, so you can leave that in. That's what he said about if you played Mass Effect 2, there's the biotic god, the Volus that you run into, who's high on a bunch of drugs and he thinks he's a god. I don't know if you played the game, but that literally my lead was like, yeah, okay, go ahead, put that in. I don't know. So that was great. Having a great lead and just churning out writing all day, every day was awesome, you know? But at the same time, you know, I think like Heart of the Swarm, I had an amazing experience because I was, you know, I had worked with Chris on Metzen on Wings of Liberty, but Heart of the Swarm was like where we really sort of figured out our groove, where like we're very complementary people together. Like I'm good at stuff that he's not great at, and he's amazing at stuff that I couldn't even begin to do, right? So you know, that so that there was that kind of relationship being the foundation of the story that we told in that game. You know, and I can basically say that about every, I won't belabor it by going through every project I've ever worked on, but each one has some kind of a thing like that for me. In terms of as a player, a little bit the same in the sense that they're all, oh, that static sound is back.
Oh no.
I don't know if it's, so in terms of the other one, in terms of being a player, it's a little bit the same thing where, you know, when I played a game has a huge impact on what the story meant to me. So I played Baldur's Gate 2 in the 90s. And because of that game, I work in games today. Like, that's why the first company I worked for was BioWare, because of Baldur's Gate 2. Now, is it a great story? Does it hold up? I don't think so. I don't know. The biggest quest in the game is get 1,000 gold, right? Like, you know, but at the time when I realized like I had a follower and he was kind of right hanging on the line between good and evil, and I realized I could like nudge him into being evil or pull him into being good, you know, I was like, that kind of blew my mind. It was that interactive nature of games. So that narrative, you know, floored me. Objectively, if I had to pick one, I would say it's Knights of the Old Republic, though. I think so much of the storytelling in that was and just the feel of the story was so spot on for that, for Star Wars. And the twist in the middle, and I don't really care about twists much, but that one literally had my jaw on the floor, just sitting there watching the cutscene where the big reveal in the middle of the game or last third or whatever unfolded. I just was like, and it was something that could only be done in video games. And if anyone hasn't seen Knights of the Old Republic and you're now curious, you should go play it. But yeah, it was literally something that could only be done in video games. So that was another super important game narrative to me. And I should say I like, you know, stuff like the Naughty Dog games where it's essentially an interactive movie right? It's such cinematic storytelling. But my tendency is much more towards more interactive stories like RPGs. So.
I think you I'm we can touch on a lot of them. But I do like the point you brought up, Brian, about certain periods of your life impacting the reception of video games. Nineball, Leviathan had brought up about his favorite Final Fantasy, and we got into a little bit of a debate over it, because it's that exact same thing. For me, the best Final Fantasy is going to be Final Fantasy VI, because
Yes, because you're right.
Because
I
you're
know,
right, exactly. Yeah.
because well, I
Sorry.
mean, one, it is the best. The villain wins, but I digress. But it also hit at the right time. It was the first Final Fantasy that, like, story-wise, I was paying attention. I played the other ones, but it was more like I can cast a spell. And Final Fantasy VI, I was ingrained. For him, it's Final Fantasy VIII because that was the age that he started paying attention to the story, and that's what grabbed him. And at that point, eight was always being compared to six for me, and it was always going to be the lesser by comparison. So sometimes it is that age that kind of traps you in it.
It's age and it's also technology. So Brian had never played a Final Fantasy game. I played seven and then I played six. And then he's like, okay, I should learn about this gigantic RPG franchise and I should
It's
try it.
because I didn't have consoles for a long time. I was a PC gamer, and I never had access to.
So he asked me, he's like, okay, you like the Final Fantasy series. What one should I start playing? And I gave him, and people gave me such shade for this. I gave him Final Fantasy X. And they're like, 10? Why did you give him 10? I was like, because if I tell him to play polygons that are just doing this at each other, like little
It's hard to
karate
go
club
back
hands, it's very
technology-wise.
hard to go back. Like, it was a moment in time when you're like, oh my God, this was like the most advanced thing I'd ever seen. But like, I tried and I loved, like, the only reason I stopped playing Final Fantasy VII is because I accidentally sold Yuffie's epic weapon. And my last save to get it would have been 40 hours prior. So my soul disintegrated. I did not do that. However, I did play Final Fantasy X and I dodged lightning 200 times to get Lulu's epic weapon because I love Lulu. So I had to play Final Fantasy X. It was still looking good.
I dodged 197 times and then a fly got my eye.
Oh
Oh no.
no.
And
No,
then
I
two days later, we were it was I was living with family over in in Europe at the time, and we were all like there was five of us that were playing off of one copy of the game, you know, memory cards and all that. Someone 2 days after that, someone saved over my file.
I would have cried.
Yeah.
I would have cried.
I watched someone else beat the game because I just couldn't do it. And still to this day, I've never gone back and replayed 10.
To be
I
fair,
did. I
he
loved 10
the
though. I
block.
finished it. Yeah. And
You even played Blitzball.
I played a
You got
lot
the
of
Waka's
Blitzball.
epic weapon.
I love Blitzball.
Okay, so but I just want to clarify, we're six, still the best. Take that, Leviathan. And D'Angelo, to come back to what you had mentioned too about Dragonflight, I haven't played WoW in years. I played when it first came out, loved every second, and then life got more complicated. But I've heard nothing but good things about Dragonflight, and I think you should be very proud of the work that went into that, because I don't know what quest it was, right? I don't know, but for a brief couple days, my timeline was just flooded with people talking about certain quests in Dragonflight, and I'm in that sphere. I hear, about WoW frequently, but not like that, right? Not like what I had been seeing in Dragonflight. I didn't see that for the previous expansion, the one before it, or the one before that, but suddenly the floodgates were open. And that was really cool because I loved the lore of Warcraft, and you guys should be proud of that.
No, that's really lovely to hear. Again, it's the team as a whole. That team is incredibly passionate and they really love what they're making. And truly, I personally feel like it was a very much a love letter to the fans to say, this is who we are, this is what we want, and this is the game that we want to make. And again, everybody loves, a lot of love was put into Dragonflight. So it's nice to hear that the fans are enjoying, because again, I look a little bit and I try not to look too hard, because I'm like, oh, well, people like, oh, I don't want to know. What if they don't? And then I turn into a tender, fragile being. There was my one delight was there was kind of what I considered a throwaway line that I had almost forgotten about that apparently turned into, to go back to your writing should be polarizing. People should love it or people should hate it. There's one line that I wrote that I kind of managed to get in there. And again, it's a pissed line. It's not like it's a big major epic line, but man, the reaction.
For those who don't know, pissed line is a Blizzard internal term. When you click on a character repeatedly and they start to say silly things or fourth yeah. wall breaking things.
Yeah.
It started in the RTS world, mm-hmm. but it carried over into.
See, so you click on a character, eventually they'll go through their whole like hello kit, goodbye kit, and then they'll say they're pissed off or again just fourth. It's real. It's called a pissed line. That's just, you know, age. It's really just a fourth wall breaking line. So my fourth wall breaking line. There's two that delighted people. One that delighted the person it was supposed to delight, and the other that just delighted and also enraged the community. So you know what? It's fine. And for those who are curious, it is Alex Straza's best line. And if you want to hear it, there's many examples of it. But
you're not going to tell us?
You're not going to. It's. She. And it was funny trying to get the read out of this actress, too, because she was like, what does this mean? I'm like, she is literally genuinely asking you. She just wants to know, do you think that I have big mom energy? That is exactly. And it's if you know anything about Alex Straza, it's kind of the perfect line for her. So
I like it. And I could see there is a contingent, as you talked about before, about, you know, on the vein of retcons, right? That mm-hmm. sometimes it isn't a retcon, it's growth, or that we as a culture and we mm-hmm. as a collective have grown, where, you know, when you have a character saying something that is a little different than what they might have, it will elicit those reactions from people who have not grown with the character yet.
Yes.
And I could see where some of that pushback might have well, been.
And again, it's because sometimes we forget that those are not, that's not the character saying that. That is a fourth wall breaking line. It's an Easter egg. It's supposed to be, it could be anything. Mm. I personally, my personal preference, it should be a little bit silly. And if I have my druthers, I don't always do. It should just be a little sly. Maybe it's a little wink at camera. Maybe it's something that I've noticed the community has talked about and just, you know, want to give back to the community.
That's a pretty good follow-up, though, too. As you guys have both worked in pretty extensive communities, like, as a writer, how much attention do you give to them? You, Brian, you brought up Reddit before, too. How much attention can you pay to what the community is saying about the IP that you're working on? You know, is it a frequent Reddit visit, or for your own sanity, do you just stay away? And, you know, do you hear from like the CM team about different things?
Community always has the temperature of, again, the community people are fantastic. They always have the temperature of what the community is about. And you should always trust your community team to know better than you do going on Reddit what's up, because that is their jobs. They are expert at them. I would say, as a general way of being, I think that Reddit and the community and like things that they're talking about should inform your decisions. Like, you should think about those and how that plays into the overall story and what people's thoughts and feelings are. But again, sometimes that's just especially with Reddit, it is a tiny slice of what people are expecting. So you have to remember that there is still a wider world out there, and you have to think of people that are not posting about it, and are do you truly think that these are the opinions of like the masses, or these are not? So it's, again, it is a fine balance, at least for me. Sorry, you asked that to Brian first, but
no, I think it's good from either. Like that's for both of you. I pay attention to Reddit, and I don't even write for any of this. So
I mean on Reaper of Souls, the community team actively discouraged the developers from going on Reddit. They would do it once a week. We would have a meeting with them, and they would tell us what people were talking about. And, you know, but they would obviously, I don't want to say sanitize it, but they would, you know, they would phrase it in a more mature way than perhaps it had been phrased on Reddit. But their reasoning is something I do agree with, is like, look, you know, let's take the figure of 30 million copies, right? Like, you're working on a game that has 30 million people bought it, right? And you can see a Reddit post, there's an angry guy who's like, you know, I'm really mad about this thing, and his 10 friends upvote it, and suddenly it feels super important, you know? And maybe it is, but just on the numbers alone, 11 people versus 30 million people, it's just statistically, it's not a good way to make decisions or to take the temperature, right? And the community team was a lot more savvy than the average developer. To be honest, most developers who go on a subreddit, they're there for confirmation bias. They want to find the thing that they told everybody else on the team was a mistake, and they want to find two people complaining about it so they can go back and say, aha, this is what everyone's saying. Or they want people to be championing it, like cheering for the idea that they championed. One of those two. They're looking for confirmation bias. But yeah, I mean, I think you have to, you know, it's good if you can take the temperature of the community, but it's a hard thing to do well and do accurately. The only time I've ever really made a specific effort to really try to just dive in to something like that was after we released Wings of Liberty. The StarCraft community was very angry. I was new to Blizzard, and I didn't yet realize that the Blizzard community will always be angry when a new game comes out. But also, you know, I felt like they had been waiting for this game for 12 years, and part of that was, that's part of why they were angry, because like there was no game that could be made that would, you know. But I really made a concerted effort. Back then it was forums more than Reddit, but like I spent a lot of time deep diving, just reading, never posting, I just lurked, but I just read everything to try to understand, like, the source of, like, what is it about this IP that you think we missed that is making you so angry, you know, that you're going on the internet to post about it instead of playing the game. And there was a lot of stuff in there that I was just kind of like, okay, I think you're mad because you played StarCraft when you were 12 and it blew your mind. Now you're 24 and nothing will ever blow your mind like that again. And that makes you angry. And I hear you. I'm angry about that too, still, right? But there was stuff in there. I started to feel like there was a sense that the parts of the community thought that the dev team didn't know or care about the lore as deeply as they did, right? And so, you know, that would, to me, was a real like, okay, well, we got to figure out why people are getting that feeling, because that's bad, right? So that's the one time I did that, where I really explicitly exposed myself to the full fury of a community. But I definitely, I want to know, better, good or bad, I want to know how people feel. But I do, when I can have a community team that will help me get a handle on how serious something is, right? Because like 10 people angry about something on Reddit is going to feel super important no matter what. And it might be important, but it might not be. And it's good to have tools to help you with that.
We've covered a lot, but... You know, before we close, I have to give the floor to Nineball for any pressing lore questions while we have you guys here. So Nineball, like, just take over.
So I really only have like two questions, because I don't really want to go like too much into like the game hasn't even released yet, so you know, spoilers and stuff in terms of Diablo 4. But we were talking a little bit before the show. There's like a little tie-in novel or collection of short stories that just recently came out called Tales of the Horogic Library. And I was actually just like really interested because something that at least because I follow the story and the lore and all that type of stuff. That's like my little niche in the community. It felt to me that the book made a concerted effort never to use the word Nephilim. It's firstborn or is ancient. Or a couple other terms that they had went through and thrown out to describe what all the other previous games, even going back to like Diablo 1 and such, had called the Nephilim. Am I just like imagining this, or was it something that you could talk about that there was a decided effort on the Diablo 4 narrative team to move away from the term Nephilim?
The point that I was on Diablo 4 is a lot more pre-production. So a lot of things were being talked about. A lot of things were being figured out. It sounds like if they did make a decision, maybe that was in full production as opposed to the point that I was at in pre-production. I would never say like if they're not using the word Nephilim. I have not actually read this short story compilation, but if they're not using the word Nephilim, perhaps there's a reason for that. But I am not privy to whether that was a conscious effort or not. So unfortunately, I can't truly answer it. But I mean, if it's not in the short story, I guess one can draw the conclusion that they're trying not to use it as much. So
yeah, like it's one of those ones that like I pick up on it. I don't know if it's like, again, maybe it's just in my head. Mm-hmm. But then the other one that I just wanted to ask, you know, for the both of you, you know, there's always so many things that like kind of like end up on the editing room floor, whether, you know, the writer or the editor. Was there a particular part of the story in like the Diablo franchise that didn't get included like in the games that you felt that you really wanted to? Like, I'll just as an example, there was the behind the scenes DVD for Reaper of Souls, where there was a brief story element where Imperius was actually going to be working with Malthiel in order to steal back the Black Soul Stone, and he was going through and becoming like corrupted, and he, you know, beat Tyriel almost to death, you know, for like betraying him and such. And he goes through, and he's the one that like picks up the Black Soul Stone, and you see his crown like get more thorny and such in the concept art. And it's like that felt like it would have been like a really cool kind of like story element to have maybe picked up on, but obviously got left at the wayside, you know, during the editing and, you know, the creative process. Was there anything that you all felt that, you know, maybe like a little story or a tidbit, you know, even something like a side quest that you felt that got cut that you would have enjoyed seeing in the games?
Again, I can't really speak to that at all because too many secrets. I'm hoping that Diablo 4 has a behind the scenes and there's some. Because again, like when you're in pre-production, when you're still figuring things out, there's a lot of ideas out there and not all of them make it. And there's one thing that I have in my mind I can't talk about, but hopefully after June 6th, there's a little more information about it that we can.
Yeah, you should have Deandra back after D4 comes out and she'll tell you what it was.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
For me, it's funny. Most of the story and storytelling that I wanted to get into Reaper got in. Being the lead has its perks. No, So what's funny is I guess the one thing that I'd say a change that I thought was for the better, but that I do miss is actually the thing you referenced. So Imperius was originally the villain of Reaper of Souls. It wasn't called Reaper of Souls then, obviously, of X1, as we called it, Expansion 1. And Malthiel was his henchman. He was like his number two guy. And we just kept running into this problem where like, damn, the Angel of Death is super interesting. and so he kind of naturally eclipsed Imperius. So I think that change was for the better. I think Malthiel, the first angel to be the villain of a Diablo story, probably should be the Angel of Death, you know. But But there was a lot of really fascinating stuff there with Imperius and the kind of sibling rivalry with Tyrael, you know. And I would say that I think we were kind of, I know we were kind of setting that up as a still a possible future thing with Imperius coming back as the villain. Oh, Deandra, I think you're staticking again.
Thank goodness. Why?
I don't know why. We were kind of setting up Imperius to come back as the villain. If you notice the final 2.5D cutscene at the end of Reaper of Souls, Nephilim is now like god level, and you know Tyrael's kind of having this moment of like, oh crap! In the Diablo universe, power corrupts absolutely, and this Nephilim is super powerful. And then like for no apparent reason, you know, Imperius is just hanging out behind him. He's just back yep. there like, hey, what's up? You know, you're kind of like, hey, okay, so whatever concern or fear that Tyrael's feeling, Imperius is freaking out, right? Like, you can't see it because he's made of light and sound. But, but you know, he's... So that was like a little hint, just that Imperius... was still lurking around and kind of having opinions about things. So that's not something that was on the cutting room floor. It actually made it in the game, but it is tied to the fact that he was once going to be the villain. He was going through his own kind of transformation the same way Malthael did to be a different aspect, right? Imperius was going to be, I think, rage. I don't remember things the way I used
Wrath.
To. Wrath. Yes, thank you. Yes, we even had the Wrath cinematic, but... Mm-hmm. But you know, so that cutting room floor thing actually did kind of make it into the final cinematic in a way that was setting up something that unfortunately never happened.
And once again,
bringing everybody down.
We've taken so much of your time, right? You have created literal worlds in the time that we've been talking. So first and foremost, thank you for coming. This is awesome. And a second part, you are always invited back to talk.
And I am not happy to jam on story. Yeah. Oh my God.
June 7th is on the calendar. Got
listen,
it right here.
I'm going to be playing. It's going to be problems. You'll have to get me while I'm in my little gremlin hood.
We'll just be there playing, you know, playing the game. And like every 5 minutes. Oh, I'm supposed to ask a question. Sorry.
Oh man, can I get you guys to carry me? That's way better. 10 out of 10. Amazing.
Well, that was like that stream that we did, Nineball. The community was like, go play the game with Nineball, and then he's gonna ask you questions. I'm like, wait, I have to play and answer questions at the same time. Are you trying to get me to do spoilers?
Yes.
So I think we will pencil it in for the 7th. Mm-hmm. Well, again, we'll all play. I'm playing hardcore, so that makes it even better.
Good luck.
Oh my God, I will not survive hardcore too long.
That's what makes it fun.
Yeah. I used to play hardcore. I just don't have the time. I don't have the free time anymore.
Neither do I. But you know, you find ways. So thank you again, guys. And we will end, as we always do, with a moo, moo, moo.
Moo? Moo. Moo.
Moo, 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 there is no cow level.
Moo-ba-moo.